From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Alex Cohen. Coming up, lots of juicy political news today. Bill Richardson, Roland Burris, Al Franken. We'll have the latest on all of them.
But first, Congress today starts trying to find out what Bernard Madoff did with $50 billion worth of other people's money. And why didn't the Securities and Exchange Commission figure that out? SEC Inspector General David Kotz will be asked about earlier investigations. Henny Sender is following the story for the Financial Times. Welcome to our program.
Many thanks.
Bernard L. Madoff Investment Securities, LLC, investigated by the SEC 8 times in 16 years, we understand. Was this whole thing so infinitely complicated nobody could see it, or was the SEC simply standing too close and couldn't see it?
The SEC is one of the most puzzling pieces of this whole thing. If you read letters from the whistleblower, you are just amazed at the case he lays out.
Harry Markopoulos is the whistleblower there, and he wrote, we understand, a 21-page report, among other communications to the SEC, saying this has got to be, the numbers don't add up, it's got to be a Ponzi scheme.
Absolutely, and it is very disheartening that the SEC did not take it more seriously. And there was a wonderful op-ed piece in the New York Times yesterday in which the authors say he should be running the SEC. Not a bad idea.
Now, this goes back, I have read over the weekend, to the 1970s. Is that possible, this scheme by Mr. Madoff?
Well, no one knows when it went off track. But what is clear is that what was required to keep it going was always more money coming in than going out. And one reason that investors were not alarmed was every time they asked for money back, they got it really, really swiftly.
And as far as the investors were concerned, they weren't getting a big return, but they were getting good returns in bad markets.
Well, it was the consistency, oddly enough, that should have been one of the biggest red flags, because it is impossible to have that kind of good, consistent return in all markets. They thought it was so stable, and a lot of people for whom stability is important thought, cannot be wrong, because if it was a Ponzi scheme, he'd go for broke.
Well, tell us about the SEC and their investigations. Has the agency just been undervalued and perhaps understaffed and not with enough talent over the last few years? What's been going on there?
I think that you had, from the very top of the Bush administration, a world that says, we don't believe in regulation, the markets know best. And when you have that kind of philosophy, why would the best people wish to work at the SEC? It was increasingly marginalized in the Bush administration. I think now there's a huge consensus that says the market doesn't always know best. You need to have regulation, and hopefully that new mantra will mean that you'll attract higher quality people to regulatory agencies.
Within the transition White House, there's a sigh of relief that this has all happened before the inauguration, but a bit of suspect news for President-elect Obama is that the person he wants to be the next SEC chairman, Mary Shapiro, has indeed been looking into this. Explain this for us.
Well, Mary Shapiro, you know, from my point of view, was rather a conventional choice. I think that you really need to go very far in the direction of people who believe strongly in regulation and investor protection. But at the same time, it is very depressing to me to come across people who are constantly saying, oh, they're going to suppress innovation. That does not seem to me to be today's problem.
Henny Sender from the Financial Times talking with us from New York. Thank you.
Thank you.
A new Congress opens in Washington this week. Even though Election Day was months ago, it's still unclear who will be sitting in the Senate chamber. And New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson has withdrawn from consideration to be the next Commerce Secretary due to an investigation into a possible pay-to-play scheme. Joining us now to talk politics, as he does most Mondays, is NPR's senior Washington editor Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Alex.
Let's start off with Governor Richardson. He says he's done nothing wrong, but he doesn't want to slow down the process of filling the post of Commerce Secretary. How serious a problem is his withdrawal for the Obama transition?
It's probably less of a serious problem than it would be if all of this had become well known after he had been confirmed. In other words, once he had taken the job. Now, if the federal grand jury grinds on for another several months, the Obama administration will have moved on and appointed another Commerce Secretary. And if, as he says will happen, Governor Richardson is totally exonerated and never indicted, well, then there could be other jobs that he could fill further on down the road in the administration.
Let's turn now to the Senate. Roland Burris of Illinois, who was recently tapped by Governor Rob Blagojevich, says he'll show up at the Senate door. Senate leaders have said they won't seat him. So what's going to happen?
I suspect we'll have a little scene that will be a lot of fun for the television cameras in the lobby outside of the Senate tomorrow. Today, the drama will be at Midway Airport in Chicago, where Roland Burris plans to have a news conference shortly before taking off and flying to Washington. Then I expect he will have some kind of a news conference when he arrives in Washington, perhaps at the airport, perhaps somewhere else. But why not at the airport, and then perhaps one on the way into Washington, and then when he arrives at the Capitol. Now, the Senate is not meeting today, so the confrontation, if there is to be one, would occur tomorrow when he attempts to be seated. But what will happen, I suspect, is that they will pass on his certification papers to the Rules Committee to be examined, and the Rules Committee will take some time to decide whether or not they think those papers are in order.
And back there in Illinois, what's the latest on the impeachment proceedings with the Governor Rob Blagojevich?
In Springfield today, members of the House Impeachment Committee are reviewing a draft summary of the allegations against Rod Blagojevich. This is a rather hefty document. As you know, he is accused of much, and they don't know exactly whether or not they're going to make any kind of recommendation out of the committee today, but partly because of the Burris involvement and the controversy about that appointment, there is a great new sense of haste about this proceeding in Springfield, Illinois. So I expect that the committee is probably going to come to some sort of a vote this week. That would mean the House could vote later this month, and the trial could begin fairly quickly in the Senate. I believe the legislature, which has never had any fondness for Rod Blagojevich, would be quite eager to get this process done in the next 4, 5, 6 weeks.
So, Ron, if the governor is impeached and Roland Burris isn't seated, how and when might the people of Illinois get a new senator and a new governor?
They will get a new governor immediately upon the impeachment of Rod Blagojevich in the person of Lieutenant Governor Pat Quinn, who would be empowered to take over. He would then probably, as one of his first acts, appoint a senator. And there would be no cloud that I know of or that has been brought to light to date over that appointment. So that person would then have a clear path to become the new senator from Illinois. One thing that Pat Quinn could do that might resolve all of this growing conflict would be to appoint Roland Burris, who would have been waiting those several weeks to take his seat and who would then have no impediment to taking his seat.
Never a dull moment. Ron Elving is NPR Senior Washington Editor. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Alex.
And in more political news today, Democrat Al Franken has been declared the winner of the Senate race in Minnesota, almost. The state canvassing board is expected to certify that Franken won the race over Republican Senator Norm Coleman by a tiny, infinitesimal 225-vote lead. The board has been recounting the 3 million votes by hand since the election back in November. And here with us now is Minnesota Public Radio's Mark Zadeklik. Mark, why isn't this all over now? I just said it was almost over. Why is it completely over?
Well, a couple technicalities, Noah. The canvassing board's meeting this afternoon. They are expected to certify the recount as complete. That does not certify a winner in the election, however. The governor of the state of Minnesota, Governor Tim Pawlenty, Republican, needs to certify the winner of the election. And that probably will not happen until any legal contests to this recount are completed. Once the canvassing board signs off on the recount, stamps it as completed, the loser will have up to 7 days, calendar days, not business days, to file a legal contest to the recount, and it's very likely that that's going to be happening, and accordingly that we will not have a certified winner for some time in Minnesota.
Well, if you stick to that calendar and start filling in the little blanks for January, do you actually go over into February when you're trying to figure out the schedule?
Well, I think that's anybody's guess right now. It just depends on what type of litigation is filed, if anything does come, and how long it takes to work it out.
Of course, Norm Coleman could say, could he not, well, okay, I'm a good sport, there it is.
Absolutely, and that is something that needs to be considered carefully for Senator Coleman. He's a relatively young man, very successful politician from his time as the mayor of St. Paul to his time in the Senate, and there's a lot of rhetoric from his legal team right now, but who knows, once this looks like it starts to get being wrapped up, the senator himself may decide that it's not politically advantageous for him to drag this into a courtroom.
If Norm Coleman were to do that, to say, well, I won't fight it any farther, isn't he in a way disenfranchising and disappointing, let's say the least, the people who voted for him?
Well, I suppose that's a risk he would have to take. I think, though, that you look at these numbers, this is so close right now, and that at some point somebody's going to have to take that Senate seat. And if Senator Coleman looks at it and decides that this is not going to behoove him, it's not going to further his political career to fight this in court, he might make that decision. And his supporters might be happy that he leaves himself potentially better positioned for another job down the road, maybe the governor of Minnesota or something.
New York Senator Charles Schumer said yesterday that Franken had already won the election. Until recently, Schumer was the head of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. Does that sort of open declaration carry weight there?
Well, enough weight that the Texas Senator John Cornyn, who's the chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, put a release out last night expressing concern about the statement that Senator Schumer made, and also noting that Senator Schumer, while he's no longer the chairman of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, he's the new chairman of the Senate Rules and Administration Committee. So I would say that what he says probably does carry some weight, and it certainly did not sit well with some Republicans in Washington.
Mark Zdechlik is following the Senate race for Minnesota Public Radio. Thank you, Mark.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen.
And I'm Noah Adams. In Mexico, drug-related violence reached new heights in 2008. There were more than 5,000 homicides linked to drugs, more than double the number the year before.
This week on Day to Day, we're airing a three-part series from the Mexican city of Juarez. It's just across the border from El Paso. Juarez is one of the main way stations for narcotics shipped from South America into the U.S. It's a place where even the most gruesome murders have come to seem almost normal. Here's independent producer Scott Carrier.
The most popular daily newspaper in Juarez is a tabloid called PM. Even though it comes out in the morning. Most of the time on the cover, there's a large photo of dead bodies from the night before. And most of the time, next to this large photo, there'll be a smaller photo of a smiling, nearly naked young woman with big breasts. Inside, along with some news stories, there are more photos of bodies, smaller for the dead men, larger for the nearly naked women, including a centerfold. Did I mention it's the most popular newspaper in Juarez? We're in a car with one of PM's photojournalists, 57-year-old Ernesto Rodriguez. His job is to get to the execution sites and photograph the crime scenes before the bodies are taken away to the morgue. To do this, he spends a lot of time zipping through traffic while talking on his cell phone and listening to the police radio at the same time.
Son aproximadamente 29 años.
I've worked about 29 years for Juarez newspapers. It's never, never been this bad. There are way too many murders because of organized crime. I don't stop working from the time my shift starts. Coming and going from murder scenes, I'm always running. And now the crimes are really, really violent. Before there were gang killings, but not so terrible as those we see now. They kill in ways that cause terror, the way they kill their enemies. La forma en que asesinan.
It's close to midnight, the middle of June, a full moon, and we're at the scene of an execution. A a side street off a tree-lined boulevard, some shops, some houses, a bar. There are flashing lights, blue, red, and yellow, from police vehicles. Mexican soldiers wearing helmets and black ski masks wait in the back of trucks. Yellow caution tape holds back a crowd of onlookers, more than 50 people, whole families standing together, quietly, whispering, looking across the yellow tape to a 1990s Lincoln Town Car under a streetlight. The window on the driver's side has a big hole in it. Inside, you can barely see it in the flashing lights, is the body of a man sitting behind the wheel, his head resting on his right shoulder. Everybody in the crowd knows the story. The man was the owner of the bar, La Academia, just across the street. He was sitting in his car, outside his bar, and somebody walked up and put a bunch of bullets into his body. It's a mild scene compared to some others. Jose Luis Gonzalez and Angel Cervantes are also photojournalists in Juarez, and they've seen much worse.
In past years, you may have seen someone executed, but not in the same circumstances that we see now. I think God has a purpose for this city. The scenes are really powerful, sometimes people with their heads and brains destroyed, their hands, their bodies torn apart. We go out on the street or to some restaurant, even to a mall or some other shopping center, and some gunfire might break out, or we might find someone who has been executed. I'll say it again, God has a purpose for this city, and I think everything is going to change.
We're living in a war, a real war, where they execute men. How many is it? 15 or more than 10 a day? Where there is no pity toward children. I have seen the worst. I saw a little girl who was with her mother, leaving a garage, and in the crossfire, the little girl was hit in the head, and she had a little stuffed bear in her arms, and she had a bullet in her head. Yeah, I've thought about leaving, going to the United States, to El Paso, the nearest city, because of the war we're living in. It's just not good here in Juarez anymore. Not for a reporter or for anyone else.
The body of the bar owner sits in the car, behind the wheel, while policemen and soldiers stand around talking, taking pictures and notes, counting bullet shells on the ground, acting as though they are beginning an investigation. But the chances there will actually be an investigation are close to zero, as nearly all violent crimes in Juarez go unpunished, and everybody here knows this. So this police work is a show. It's a ritual. The police and the army bring the flashing lights and the ski masks, the flak jackets and the caution tape. They block off the stage around the dead body and the onlookers, people from the neighborhood, people who've stopped while driving by. They stand like they're in a church at a mass. But instead of organ music and a choir, there's the sound of voices talking over a police radio. After 2 hours, the body is taken from the car, placed on a stretcher, covered with a white sheet, and then lifted by four men into the back of a white van. The van drives away, the crowd disperses, the ceremony is over. But the ritual will not be complete until tomorrow morning, when a photo of the man's body behind the steering wheel appears in the tabloid PM, next to photos of nearly naked young women. For NPR News, I'm Scott Carrier.
Culiacán, capital sinaloense, convirtiéndose en el mismo infierno, fue testigo de tanta masacre. ¿Cuántos hombres valientes han muerto? Unos grandes que fueron de Lampa y otros grandes también del gobierno.
This story was produced by Julian Cardona, Scott Carrier, and Lisa Miller for HearingVoices.com.
Tomorrow, in part two of our Juarez series, the Mexican president sends in the army to combat drug violence. Some now question the wisdom of that decision.
You can explore more of Juarez and other border towns in an interactive map. It's found at our website, npr.org.
Solo hay luto y paz.
familia llorando. Tierra Blanca se encuentra muy triste, ya sus calles están desoladas, no transitan los carros del año, ni se escucha el rugir de metrallas, las mansiones que fueron de reyes.
President-elect Barack Obama promised to bring change to Washington, and residents of the nation's capital are taking him at his word. He may have been talking about the Washington of Capitol Hill and K Street, but there's another side of the city that's also gearing up for the next president. Reporter Danielle Anastasian has more.
It's lunchtime at Players Lounge, and catfish sizzles in a deep fryer. Owner Georgine Thompson boasts some of the best soul food in Southeast Washington.
We have T-bone, smothered chops, chitlins, mashed potatoes, macaroni and cheese, yams, stuffing. This place is the real D.C.
Players is in Ward 8, right on the Anacostia River. It's one of the only sit-down restaurants in a neighborhood that's become synonymous with poverty and crime. One in three residents in Ward 8 lives below the poverty line. Community organizer Philip Pinnell has been coming here for decades.
This is very much the other side of the tracks. This is the other side of the river. People do not come over here to sightsee. I mean, go in and look at the conditions of our schools. Considering the fact that this is the nation's capital, and you see a community like this, it makes you sometimes want to cry.
Ward 8 is a world away from the white marble monuments of Northwest D.C. Schools here are in disrepair, and gunfights are commonplace. Activist Jeffrey Richardson calls Washington a city with a split personality.
I always tell people, I mean, there's the nation's capital and there's the District of Columbia, and often the two never meet.
Some hope an African American, especially one who knows the underside of a city, will somehow integrate the two Washingtons. Obama has already given more attention to Southeast D.C. than either Bush or Clinton. And on the campaign trail, he unveiled his urban economic agenda right here in Ward 8.
We stand not 10 miles from the seat of power in the most affluent nation on earth. And yet here on the other side of the river, every other child in Anacostia lives below the poverty line.
Activists like Richardson were ecstatic.
He could have gone anywhere in the country, any other city, but he did that right here in Southeast D.C. So that's the kind of, you know, this, again, sort of the tone. Somebody sees us. Oh, my God, you know, Barack Obama knows we're here.
Obama got over 99% of the vote here. But Ward 8 has long been used as a backdrop for politicians promising change. 6 days after being sworn into office, D.C. Mayor Adrian Fenty toured a rundown housing complex in Anacostia. 47-year-old Kenny Narain argues that these cameo appearances don't change things.
D.C. Upper Northwest still gets preferable treatment. The streets are clean first. You know, the snow's being plowed first.
At Players Lounge, there's constant chatter about what an African-American president means for the city.
He has to focus on the nation as a whole before he can really start focusing on communities.
Most residents here are realistic that change won't come overnight. Tawanda Sparrow.
We're not looking at him and saying, oh, he's an African-American, he's going to take care of us. No, we all want the same thing. I mean, it's about America coming back and being on top of things, being on top, because at one point we had everything together.
Philip Pinnell is waiting for Obama to deliver.
People, you know, they like the symbolism, and they'll get a charge out of that for a good couple of weeks and months. But then, you know, like they're going to be looking for something really tangible.
For now, this predominantly African-American city is buzzing about welcoming Obama to town. Players Lounge is catering two inaugural balls, and customers hope to lure the president here for some home cooking. Kenny Narain says he'll be waiting.
This is the right place to be. It's just I'll buy him his first drink.
It's just like South Side Chicago.
For NPR News, I'm Danielle Anastasian in Washington, D.C.
From NPR News, it's Day to Day. The governor of Washington State wants to save some money by sending illegal immigrants home, especially immigrants serving time in state prisons. The state figures it can save almost $5 million a year by turning those prisoners over to the feds for early deportation. And as NPR's Martin Costi reports now from Seattle, the idea is catching on.
Washington's Secretary of Corrections, Eldon Vale, says he's not thrilled about releasing illegal immigrants from prison early. But with the state facing a $5 billion budget deficit, he has to make cuts somewhere.
The idea is that we would identify those who have been convicted of either drug or property nonviolent offenses and deport them.
Of course, it's not the state that would deport them. It would release the inmates into the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which would then initiate the usual legal process for deportation. Arizona has been doing something similar since 2005 and has saved $26 million. It seems like a good deal all around. The state saves money, the immigrant gets out of jail early, but immigration lawyer David Leopold recommends caution.
Many of these people may have the right to stay in the United States, notwithstanding their offense. We could be talking about breaking up families, separating parents from children forever. When you talk about sending somebody away to save money, we need to make sure that everybody's rights are protected.
Leopold is vice president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. One of his colleagues, Kathleen Walker, says she also worries about fairness for another population, the American inmates.
We will have basically discrimination here set in our state law, where U.S. citizens won't get this deal, but foreign nationals will.
This is actually a rare point of agreement between opposing sides in the immigration debate.
Illegal immigrants should not be treated better than American criminals.
Ira Malman is spokesman for the Federation for American Immigration Reform, a group that generally argues for the prompt deportation of illegal immigrants. But he says not if it means giving them special breaks on prison sentences.
People who are in the country illegally ought to be deported at the end of their sentences. But the penalty for having committed a crime in the state of Washington shouldn't simply be a ticket back to whatever country you came from.
The fact that this sense of unfairness cuts across political lines like this is certainly on the mind of Washington State Secretary of Corrections. We asked him if this program meant that an American inmate would have to watch immigrants with similar sentences get out of jail ahead of him.
Yes, he would.
What do you think about when you ponder that?
These are tough choices.
Tough choices are becoming routine for state governments facing huge budget deficits. Eldon Vale recently attended a conference of corrections officials from around the country, and he says his colleagues showed a lot of interest in Arizona's experience releasing inmates early for deportation. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
This is Day to Day. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Alex Cohen. There are hundreds of thousands of restaurants all over the world, but fewer than 70 of them have earned 3 stars in the famed Michelin guides. Andy Haler has made it a mission to eat at as many of those 3-star restaurants as he can. He joins us now on the phone from his home in London. Welcome to the program, Andy. And can you tell us approximately how many of these restaurants have you eaten at to date?
Well, I've eaten at all of them, actually. So there were, in 2008, there were 68 3-star restaurants, and in November I went to the last of those. Until the 2009 season kicks off, I've pretty much been to all of them.
And this has all been, we should note, on your own tab, flying to these places, eating at them. I can't imagine this is an inexpensive hobby. Might I ask how you were able to afford all of this?
I don't actually think it's an incredibly expensive hobby. I mean, if you compare it to, say, wanting to drive the best car in the world, you know, I think it's just what I mostly spend my money on. And, you know, I live in London. I don't even bother with owning a car in London because you have such good public transport here. So I save some money that way.
Andy, you have dined all over the world. Can you describe some of your absolute favorite three-star meals?
Yes, I think one of my long-term favorites has been a place called Louis Cannes in Monaco, just on the French Riviera. That's a place with fantastic ingredients. So you get tremendously good local markets there. Another one which might surprise people is probably the best meal I had last year. Was actually in Germany. And I think German food is, you know, you tend to think of it a bit like
sauerkraut
British.
And sausages and things like
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's the best of times, it was the worst of times, you know. but they are serving French food, I have to say.
So, this is a restaurant in Germany, but they served fine French fare.
Yeah. And all of the three stars in Germany do that. And none of them actually serve, you know, sort of pig's lung and bratwurst and so on, I'm afraid.
You write a food blog and you write about these restaurants you go to, but unlike other restaurant critics, you're paying for your own meals. Do you think that gives you a different perspective?
I think it does, and I think it means that I care quite a lot about value for money. Now, that may sound kind of strange for someone who's eating in very expensive restaurants, but it does mean that I, you know, even in the top places, I actually care about what I'm getting for my money, because it's my money. If you're being paid to go by the New York Times or whatever, you know, then, you know, you can go to somewhere like Massa in New York and spend, you know, I think it's $540 before you've even, including service, before you've even had a drink. And, you know, you can have that meal and think,
On what? I'm just flabbergasted.
No, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's $450, you know, but there's 20% service automatic, and that's before you've had a drink. It's a sushi bar, you know, and that has three stars. And to me, it was ridiculously expensive for what it was. You know, when in Tokyo, I could also go to a three-star sushi bar that was better, and that was $120, including drinks.
Andy, just curious, on days that you're not doing the three-star meals, what do you normally eat? Do you keep up the kind of fine cuisine, or do you just kind of do sandwiches and hamburgers so you can really appreciate those good gourmet meals?
It's kind of varied. I do eat out about 5 days a week, but I also have to go to the gym 5 days a week to sort of try to pay for that. On the other days, I mean, I'm very fond of Indian food, for example, which is a very strong thing in London, and very, very happy to go to little sort of, you know, cafes and so on, have, you know, fish and chips or something if it's good. And to me, it's all about whether it's good in its context, you know. So to me, you know, you can have really superb, say, you know, fish and chips or superb hamburger. You know, those are all, you know, to me, sort of equally valid as something that's, you know, it's very, very fancy.
The 2009 Michelin editions just came out. Are there any new three-star restaurants that you're really excited about in the year to come?
One of them was Massa in New York, so I wasn't very excited about that, I must say, which I went to. I'm actually quite excited about one of the ones in Hong Kong, which is a Chinese restaurant. That'll be the first three-star Chinese restaurant, and that you know, could be potentially really exciting.
Andy Haler writes about food on his food blog, andyhaler.com. Thank you so much, Andy.
Thank you very much indeed.
One location Andy Haler probably hasn't found yet is Chef Julian's Place. And that's because Chef Julian Cruiser doesn't have his own restaurant yet. He does, though, have his own cooking show. It's called Big Kitchen with Food, and it airs on Portland, Oregon Public Access Cable Television. And Julian Cruiser is only 5 years old.
And then you add some of the, what is it called? And then you add some of all the zucchini, the zucchini you chopped up.
Julian Cruiser and his mother, Kristen McKee, welcome to you both. Hi, Kristen.
Hello.
Hi, Julian.
Hi.
Tell us how you started cooking so young, under five.
I was watching PBS on television, like I do, and I saw sometimes, like in the middle of the cartoons or after a cartoon, there's a cooking show, and that's what gave me the idea of my cooking show.
How long ago was that, really?
When I first started cooking, that was like when I helped Kristen cook dinner.
How far back, Kristen, was that?
Oh, I used to carry him in a pouch, a sling.
Sure.
And so I would do the cooking while he was there. He was there right with me from the very beginning. Later, he, you know, asked if he could maybe stir something or cut something up or use some of the tools in the kitchen. And sometimes, one time he went out and made some toasted olives for the neighbors. That was probably the first time he took initiative. He was about 3 years old when he did that.
Yeah, but another time, when I was four, I woke up before Kristen and Ben.
That's his parents.
Right.
Yeah. And I went out in the kitchen and made fried eggs all by myself.
Kristen, did you ever have concerns about Julian being right there with all the flames and the knives and things like that in the kitchen?
Not more than I have concerns about him being in the rest of the world. I think he's a trustworthy person, and I'm always there to guide him as best I can.
Right. Does he stand up on a stool to get to the counter?
Actually, now he's kind of good at sort of vaulting himself up there.
Oh, he gets on the counter.
Yeah, he can get on the counter, or he uses a stool if he needs to.
Julian, are you making food that is yours alone, your own recipes?
All the ones before Yummy Yummy Citrus Boys were ones that I didn't make up.
Yummy Yummy Citrus Boy is your first recipe. What is it?
They're little boys. They look like gingerbread men, but they have different ingredients.
And what do they taste like?
I don't really know what they taste like, but I can taste the powdered sugar on top of them.
I'll bet. Kristen, your son's show is local on Portland Public Cable Access Television. Any idea of making it a national program? Any dream of that?
I personally don't have any dreams about that. It's mainly Julian's interest. It is also on the internet. I believe we have it on blip.tv. But that wasn't the goal of it. I think when Julian started doing this, it was, like he said, because he wanted to have fun.
Hey, Julian, you want to be a chef when you grow up?
Well, I kind of already chose to be a person who works at a place where they send out TV.
And a television station.
Yeah, and a television station.
But not a restaurant.
Maybe I can have two jobs, like having a restaurant and being a TV chef.
Julian Cruiser is 5 years old. He has his own cooking show in Portland, Oregon. It's called Big Kitchen with Food. His mother is Kristen McKee. Thanks to both of you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bye.
And you can find the link to Chef Julian's show and his recipe for that chocolate chip zucchini bread on our blog. That's npr.org/daydreaming.
Back now with Day to Day, and back as well, humorist Brian Unger, here with a few words about getting back into the swing of things, or not. Here's today's Unger Report.
Today, on this, the fifth day of the new year, it's the first day back to work for that part of America that still has a place to call work, in a workplace at which a job still exists or hasn't yet been eliminated. If you're one of those people, welcome back. If you're beginning the new year without a job, the first thing you should do is put some pants on. Then draw back the curtains and bravely face the day and confront the new reality of unemployment. It's not going to be easy. There will be challenges like staving off hunger or stopping that guy with tattoos from taking your car in the middle of the night. But there is one challenge bigger than all the requisite phone calls, emails, resumes, and job interviews, and that is what to do with all your spare time. You could sit at home and wait to feel the curative effects of TARP, the Troubled Assets Relief Program, but you'll be dead by then. Instead, here's the most important piece of advice on how to spend all your free time from someone who is accustomed to being unemployed or fired a few times, who has a job as of right now but won't soon on a program that is still on the air but won't be in 11 weeks because of an NPR budget shortfall. My advice, don't be efficient at doing anything. For example, don't combine trips like going to the gym, stopping at a store, swinging by the post office, then picking up dry cleaning, when you could turn each of those activities into four separate day-long adventures. Go to the post office, but in a neighboring county. For fresh produce,
Drive to Pennsylvania and visit an Amish vegetable stand. Buy your own petrochemicals to make dry cleaning solution from scratch. You have no job and 12 hours to fill each day, so make every hour count by wasting as much time as you can by never performing more than one function or running more than one errand at a time. Efficiency is for losers with jobs. You're a winner without a paycheck and pesky time constraints. Consider yourself promoted to Vice President of Time Killers. Call a friend, write a poem, climb a mountain. You've got absolutely no work to do and a lot of time to not do it. So don't go hurrying up and getting busy. And that is today's Unger Report. I'm Brian Unger.
Humorist Brian Unger, working, for the moment anyway, every Monday here on Day to Day.
Also still working, and occasionally even shopping, our musical contributor David Was.
There's no better place to bring your cultural barometer than the fabulous 99-cent store, where in between finding sub-dollar treasures, one can listen to some of the worst pop music of the last three decades. I shop there enough to know the store is on some kind of six-hour loop tape that Satan must have devised in Hades with the help of 15 evil undead record executives to inflict maximum torture on staff and clientele alike. A few clicks on the old Google and I found my way to the website of the company that invented and perfected this form of oral waterboarding, Muzak LLC. Lo and behold, the homepage features a quote from one Linda L., a confessed 99-cent store denizen who's quoted as saying, "I do not have a business, but I'm so impressed with the music that's being played at the 99-cent store that I found myself shopping longer just to hear the music." First off, Linda L. needs professional help, not only with her taste in music, but in being impressionable enough to want to cull the aisles of nearly expired goods just to hear another spin of Basha's Cruisin' for Bruisin', one of the staples of the Top 99 hit parade. Come to me and cry. Chances are the old 99er went with what Muzak calls its rock show program, a smattering of classic rock songs aimed at adults age 18 to 60 that are medium low to high energy and created especially for mini marts, casual restaurants, and specialty retail shops. Do fries come with that "Listen to the Music" by the Doobie Brothers? According to Muzak exec Bob Finnegan, music has the most direct and most powerful impact on the retail customer experience. What does Steely Dan's "Ricky Don't Lose That Number" have to do with buying no-brand cans of tomato soup? Oh, wait, I get it. The number in question is 99, as in 99 cents. I knew something made me buy that package of frozen pork egg rolls against my better judgment. I thought a little wild time had just begun. Donald Fagen is included in Muzak's menu of smooth jazz vocals, a designation he'd probably object to strenuously, especially when the company describes such music as silky, inviting, and self-assured. Or perhaps you shopkeepers would prefer that customers feel earnest, genuine, and confident, in which case the new country playlist would suit your emporium best. Enter Keith Urban or Carrie Underwood, and the merch starts flying off the shelves, especially the hominy grits and pork sausage, I would assume. Standing at the back door, she tried to make it fast. Once you hit the hardwood, it all makes one nostalgic for a time when psychology PhDs were interested in curing people of neuroses and hysteria, not helping turn them into music-driven retail automatons. Or even further back in the mists of time, when music was the soundtrack for tribal rituals celebrating life's hairpin turns, birth, death, springtime, the harvest. I hate to use the S word except in an emergency, but yes, music was a spiritual enterprise. That it has now been yoked to the cash register to induce us to make gratuitous purchases gives a whole new meaning to the old refrain, "Buy, buy, birdie. Just don't pay full price." Time to say goodbye.
Bye now.
That is Anne Margaret from the film Bye Bye Birdie. Contributor David Was is half of the musical duo Was Not Was.
When you get home,
Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Cohen.
And I'm Noah Adams.